said, I want to meet with every one of those 100 people, and we let them go. And I did. Every one of them came in my office, and I met with them, and I said, look, I hope to hire you back. I'm trying to save this company.
Hello, and welcome back to the Creative Society Animation Podcast. I'm Michael Wakelam. If you're new to the podcast, the format is pretty simple. I chat with talented people from across the industry about everything from the art and business side of animation, and we often do a deep dive, talking through a career. I feel very privileged to have these conversations. I started doing this during the pandemic to occupy my curious mind and also so I could talk to people while we were isolated. And I hope it's been that and more to you too. It's really grown since then, and the wonderful guests are what make it great. We're all busy, so the fact that these talented guests give their time to share their experience with us is something that's not lost on me. I'll be winding up this season shortly to focus on some projects for a couple of months, but before I do, there are a couple more episodes lined up that I'm really excited to share with you. Today's guest is Rick Michel. Let me just say, what a great guy. I met Rick at my very first Kid Screen, a story that we recount at the start of this episode. It was a pivotal moment for how I now approach lots of opportunities. Rick is a real study on how to do things right. And look, animation is a great industry, loaded with super friendly and wonderful people. But of course, like any industry, not everyone does it right. I'm talking about the how to treat people part of doing it right. I could really chat with Rick for hours, and I guess this was like a mini mentoring session, and Rick would really be a great mentor to have. Anyway, if you enjoy this episode, please like, rate, or share on social media and in random cafes on napkins. Without further ado, Rick Michel. Rick, great to see you. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
I am so glad I bumped into you in Annecy and we were able to organize this. For me, you know, this is just a great chance, obviously, to chat more with you and just to get to know you a bit more. So I'm really looking forward to it. We have an interesting meeting story, which I'll recount shortly.
We also have a common dress code, I see. So that's good.
Yeah, very, very similar. Yeah, for the listeners, this is just audio, obviously, but we almost identical shirts on.
Yeah.
So now you've had a long career as a producer and an exec, and you know, working at Mainframe, Technicolor, Sony, Bardell. You know, I want to get into as much as that as we can today to get all of your wisdom and suck it out of your brain and let all of our listeners hear all that. But before we even do that,
5 minutes, then I don't know what we'll do the rest of the time, but okay.
Before we do that, I think we should recount the first time we met. I don't know, perhaps I'll start and you can fill in bits from your side because you probably see it a little bit differently than me. But it was my first Kid Screen, which I believe was 2017, 2018. Actually, just to even rewind a little bit further than that, the previous October was my first MIPCOM. And I, at that MIPCOM, had no idea what I was doing, really. I was with the UK delegation, and there was a guy on that trip, Michael Stanish, and he insisted that I go out partying with him. At probably the third party, I guess, of that night that we went to, I met Fonda Snyder. And if listeners, if you haven't heard the episode that we did with Fonda, which was one of my first, you should certainly go back and listen to her story, which is fantastic. But fast forward to Kid Screen the next year, and I had arranged to meet Fonda and chat about what I was developing. But just before that meeting, there was a panel about pitching that I was headed to, and it's a panel that you were moderating, Rick.
That's right. That's right. I was moderating, and you know, it's always interesting to do a panel about pitching because you can talk about it, but you really want to try and find someone in the audience who's willing to actually do a pitch in front of everyone else, which is quite courageous and hard to find.
Yeah, well, I got there early, and I think, you know, we're about 10 or 15 minutes early, and I was in the front row, and you came down, and you were like, yeah, I just want to make this real, and who wants to do a 30-second pitch to the panel? And for a start, a 30-second pitch is tough, you know.
The elevator pitch, you know, it's hard, but you should be able to compress at least initially, your pitch into a log line that's pretty short.
Yeah, exactly. And so I said, all right, I'll do this.
I was either crazy or courageous, but I admired you for doing it. I mean, your mistake was sitting in the front row, I guess.
No, it wasn't a mistake. I mean, you know, actually, I have the audio right here for that podcast, and I'm going to not to of that pitch. I'm going to share that. Let's do that right now.
Oh, wow.
And you know, I've only got that audio because a friend of mine who was there recorded the whole thing.
All right, I'm Michael Wakeland. I'm from Anthem Studios in London. We have a hybrid comedy-driven show which combines live-action documentary footage with two cheeky little characters who don't always tell the truth. The show's called The Wild Truth, and the characters are kept in line by a narrator. We have a full outline, and we have about 2.5 minutes of animation.
And what are the characters? Are they humans, or are they
animals? No, they're animals. They're quolls.
And, but they're, it's live action?
No, the characters are animated.
I see, it's a hybrid.
Yeah, hybrid, yeah.
This is a perfect, like, I kind of picked a better person here, because it's a very interesting property. So thank you, Michael, you're very brave. Okay.
That's funny. That's really funny.
I mean, and not only, obviously, not only did I get there and do that, I mean, as you ask, my brain said yes and my heart said no, or perhaps the other way around. But I knew I had to do that, and it was in the big room, which ended up being very full. And Fonda was on the panel, which I didn't even realize going into that panel. And she became a real champion of that project, and still is, because it still hasn't been made, by the way. Anyone who's interested. But then I was in LA the following month, and I had the opportunity to meet with you at Sony, and also found out only then that Fonda is your partner.
That's correct. She's my better half. And, you know, it's sometimes challenging having two people in the same business, but we seem to make it work. It's been, you know, over 15 years now. So awesome. There you go.
So the moral of that story is, of course, to just do it. You know, if an opportunity presents itself like that, be the first one to say yes and spend the next 15 minutes figuring it out as you panic.
I think that's a good moral for life in general for your career path. You know, if it's something you want to do and you get any kind of an opportunity, say yes, even if it's not perfect or it's not, you're not being paid the right amount of money you think you should be making, or you say yes and you grab the opportunity, and from that, something will come out of it.
All right, so Rick, let's now rewind. I want to go back to the start of your career and talk about how you got started down this creative path. Was it an area or a career and an industry that you always wanted to be involved in? And you can go back as far as you want if you like. You're back to your teenage years or your toddler years.
Well, you know, in my teenage years, you know, I was a huge consumer of filmed entertainment. I watched, you know, a lot of old movies from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. I went to the theater when I was very young and, you know, saw Godfather and, you know, all the kind of Easy Rider and all these movies, even though I was quite young, you know, I mean, I was 10 years old seeing the Godfather. But I love film and I love television. I watched a lot of television and film. I thought it'd be great to do something in that milieu. And so I was a really good student. I went to law school, Stanford Law School, and I thought, okay, well, what am I going to do? You know, when you're in law school in the States, you work in summers. You work for law firms as an intern, a paid intern, and you see what it's like to practice law. And I kind of knew I didn't love practicing law, but I thought, well, I'll try for entertainment law. And I'll learn about our industry. It seemed like a good path. And I was lucky enough to end up at a firm called Melvin & Myers that had a lot of big entertainment clients. And I was able to work on contracts and financing and distribution for a lot of clients in the entertainment industry. And that's how kind of I learned a lot about the business. You know, this theme of every opportunity, even if it's not exactly what I wanted, you take things from that. You learn things that you don't even know you're going to apply later. I got a good story coming up about that. But that really worked for the law. I learned a lot about the entertainment biz. After 2 years, I didn't want to practice law. I went and worked for a small independent feature company. And I did kind of half legal stuff for them. That was my entree to get the job. Mm-hmm. And then half production and creative. So that's where I learned kind of creative and how to do notes on a script and working with the international distributors, how to piece together financing for movies. That was a company called Electric Pictures, and well known for their series of horror films called Waxwork, Waxwork 1 and Waxwork 2. But we had done a lot of those indie films, and I learned a lot there. But my real seminal job was when I started in acquisitions at Live Entertainment. Live was the predecessor to Lionsgate in LA, and I was started in family acquisitions. But I have to jump back a bit before that, because prior to that job, I had decided to take time off. I just really was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I thought, well, I'm just going to kind of go do some crazy stuff. And I went and I worked at Club Med, and I worked as a GO. And one of the things that GO are the people that kind of work there, and the GMs are the guests. You know, that's the Club Med terminology. And I was a GO in the kids club in Colorado at a ski resort. And I took care of kids every morning. We'd take them out skiing and bring them back for lunch. And we'd show them movies. And we did a clown show. And we'd do a scavenger hunt and all these things during the day to keep them entertained while their parents were out skiing. When I came back from that job, you know, it was a temporary job, 6 months. I had to look for a job. And I had this opportunity to interview at Live. And they needed someone in family acquisitions, which meant I was going to go to the markets, MIPCOM and Kids Green and, you know, other markets, and look for family programming that we could distribute in the United States. We had a big DVD label called Family Home Entertainment that needed a lot of product. So I would go around the world looking for that product. When I interviewed with the CEO, a guy named Roger Burlidge, who's almost 80 now and still a friend of mine and was a real mentor in my life. That's another thing, by the way, taking opportunity is one. Two is, finding good mentors. He was a great mentor for me. I interviewed with him and he said, well, what do you know about kids entertainment? You know, it says here you were a lawyer, then you worked for this indie production company. I don't understand. He said, well, Roger, every day, you know, for 8 hours a day, I had to keep kids entertained. And that meant seeing what they responded to, sometimes watching DVDs, sometimes putting on shows and knowing, you know, how kids thought. I like that story. I like that a lot. I'm going to hire you. And he hired me. And, you know, a large part, I didn't have a lot of experience doing that. He knew I was a smart guy and I'd been a lawyer, so I could negotiate the deals to acquire this programming. But he put some faith in me. And that Club Med job, you know, is an example of something you never think would come back to help you.
Yeah.
But it did. And that really set me on my career. And mid-1990s, he was a great mentor to me. Eventually, I rose to be head of all acquisitions. So I did kids and, film. And I went to Cannes and Toronto Film Festival and Sundance. And I learned, you know, the whole business. And he really promoted me. And my first MIPCOM was when I was at Live. And I didn't know what I was doing either. I went there and I just kind of learned by doing. And so that set me on a path. And when that company was sold, Roger again came to me and he said, hey, I got an opportunity to raise money to buy this company called Harvey Entertainment. Harvey was the Harvey Comics company. So we had Casper the Friendly Ghost and Richie Rich and Wendy the Witch, all this great intellectual property. He said, you're the family expert. He said, why don't you write the business plan with me? And if we raise the money, you'll be president, I'll be CEO, and we'll run the company together. And it was a public company, a NASDAQ company. And we ended up buying the company. And that was my first opportunity as a leader of a company, you know, because Roger kind of took a back seat and he let me really run the company with him as a great support as the CEO. And
so how old were you then, roughly?
I was about late 30s.
Yeah,
about 38. You know, I was late 30s. And, you know, when you think about it, you know, I had been an executive, I had been a lawyer, but I'd never been responsible for a whole company, you know, and we were a merchandising company. We were a content producing company. We were a comic book company. We had a lot of different areas. And, you know, I just kind of went with my instincts. you know, we successfully managed a company and then sold it to Classic Media, which then became part of DreamWorks. So all the Harvey intellectual property is still with DreamWorks. And through the sale we made after 4 years at Harvey. And that led to my next jump as the CEO of Mainframe, because Mainframe had been a vendor of ours. They had produced a Casper movie for us, and their management team had departed, and the board needed to find someone, and they came to me, and I was given that opportunity, which again was a seminal opportunity for me.
Yeah, going back to your, you know, the first leadership role there, what were some of the biggest challenges for you taking on that type of role for the first time?
Human resource management is always a big challenge. You know, you want to find the right people for the right job and try and make sure that they're happy in their job. You want to create a culture where people can thrive and do their job. So that balance between micromanaging and delegating is something I think you have to practice and learn. Finding the right people, you have to kind of have an instinct for it. And really managing overhead and knowing where you need people and where you don't, and knowing, you know, where your skills are and what you should be doing every day versus everyone else, I think is important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, learning to trust your gut and trust your instincts and knowing that you're not going to know everything. That's really the most important thing. That saying, I don't know, you know, thinking about things, knowing that it's okay not to know the answer. That's a big deal.
The best leaders are the ones that can be humble like that and admit that they don't know everything and reach out and hire people who do know that.
It's a balance between, you know, having the confidence in your decision making, but knowing that sometimes you won't know and you'll need to gather more information before making that decision. So it's really that constant balance every day.
So then you're at Mainframe.
Mm-hmm.
And that was more production oriented, would you say?
Yeah, we were first time I ran what is really a full-blown animation studio with artists, 400 artists, and working on high-level intellectual property for other clients, right? At Harvey, I was a client.
Yeah.
Now, I ran the studio. You know, there was a real combination of corporate stuff I had to deal with, because that company, when I got there, was 6 months away from bankruptcy. I didn't know that. I knew that they had been suffering, but I didn't realize how dire the circumstances are. So that situation calls on your skills more than any other situation I've ever been in. You know, it's interesting because I was a good student. One of my favorite subjects was history. And when I got to Mainframe and I saw where we were in the first week, I sat down with the CFO and he told me, and I said, we're headed for bankruptcy here. And to go into bankruptcy, most people may not know, you need to go into bankruptcy at that time with about $1 million so that you can come out of bankruptcy at some point. If you go in with zero, you're done. The company's dissolved. But if you go into bankruptcy and seek protection when you have at least $1 million, you can negotiate with your creditors. So I knew we had about 4 months, is my point.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked back in history and I remembered when Franklin Roosevelt was elected president of the United States. He came in when the Depression had started. He assumed office in 1932, worst time of the Depression. And he immediately enacted, within 1 week, a 100-day plan to turn the country around. 100 days, I remembered that. In my head, I said, I'm going to have a 100-day plan. And so I sat down with my executive team, who I just met, who were a great group of young, bright people. I said, all right, we're going to come up with a 100-day plan. First of all, we have 100 artists here who aren't working. At the time, the model was you keep people employed even if they're not on a project.
Mm.
We said, well, we have to sever those people immediately. So I need you within the next 10 days to tell me which 100 people we can lose and still maintain our ability to produce the shows we are producing. It was 100 out of 300. Now, that costs you money because you have to do severance, but it's still in the 4 months, you're buying days. That's what it was. I need to buy a week here and a week there. Mm. I said, I want to meet with every one of those 100 people when we let them go. And I did. Every one of them came in my office and I met with them. And I said, look, I hope to hire you back. I'm trying to save this company. I want you to know it wasn't personal. We just had to do it. And I met with all of them. And that was just something I felt in my gut I should do. I wanted them to understand. Then I stood before the company in the second week. I did a whole presentation on our financials. I let them see everything and how dire the circumstances were. I said, I'm going to propose that we all take a pay cut, including myself, 5% pay cut, starting next week. This will help the company survive longer. I'm asking you all for your participation. In return, I'm going to give you all options, stock options that are worth that equal to that 5% of the pay cut that you're making. So you'll have a stake in the company. You know, again, I don't know where I got this stuff. I just kind of, you know, some of it was at like 100 days, you know. They went with me, you know. I the employees were with me. They saw the numbers. And in fact, I did a podcast last week with the guy who runs Think Tank, a school in North Vancouver that turns out really great graduates for animation. And he worked at Mayfair. He recounted to me in detail that speech in the cafeteria. Wow. He remembered it. It really impacted him.
That's, I mean, you know, there's a couple of things there. The meeting with 100 people, I mean, I've had to let people go in the past, and you always want to meet with them, and especially if they're good, you want to be able to hire them back. But to do that with 100 people is a different challenge. To do it one-on-one, you know, most people would just probably, you know, get everyone together in a room and talk to them together. But, you know, that's really interesting. And it's those things and, you know, stock options and... stock options is a really important one because that invites people to get on the boat, doesn't it? It invites people to take ownership in the company and in their position. And if they're doing that, they're more likely to see their place in the success or failure as pivotal.
That's right. They have a stake in the outcome. And they saw that I was being transparent. They knew that I wasn't just looking to cut their salary. I took a cut too.
Yeah.
After starting 2 weeks earlier, you know, they felt that they had a part of it. They were invested in the result, and we did it. We turned the company around. You know, a client came to us and stuck with us, Mattel, who they knew our numbers because we were a public company. But the executive at Mattel was someone that I had known and worked with when I was at Live. Much earlier on, he actually had been a producer that had pitched me projects at Live that I had passed on. But he said to me, you know, Rick, I always remember how you treated me with respect. And when you passed, you called me and you told me why you were passing. And I remembered that. And I'm going to stick with you. We'll stick with you guys. And then I brought in a new client, Hearst, to do a Popeye special. And I had known them because I had bought a lot of programming as an acquisitions executive from them. Mm-hmm. Again, they kind of believed in us and came and we did this Popeye special. So we slowly started getting more revenue in. And then we reduced our overhead. We kept buying time. Now I had 9-10 months. And then I found an investor in the company that put up over $10 million. Bought 60% of the company. Now, if you think about a company that was on the verge of bankruptcy, that means that company is worth, you know, $14 million. That's pretty good that we got that $10 million to come in. And that was it. The company was righted. We righted the ship and we were off and running. It was a good situation. That investor turned out to be a little tough to manage, but all in all, we saved the company and, it's still going today, as you know.
Yeah, it is. That, you know, that philosophy, everyone, I mean, a lot of people obviously who listen to this podcast would be pitching. I know a lot of people, including myself, who are constantly pitching, founders often pitching. And the response that you were talking about giving there about, you know, always giving a reason and giving a phone call or getting back to someone, it doesn't seem to be the norm in the industry.
I lament the fact that it's not the norm. I think if you have a good mentor, your mentor, you know, teaches you that. And I learned that early on, that how you treat people will, it's circular, right? Yeah. I mean, you treat people a certain way, you're going to run into those people again, or you're going to be in the position of pitching one day. So for me, I always remember that. But you're right. It's sad that now people feel that they can ignore people. They can take weeks to answer emails. You know, the way I came up, you answered every email within 24 hours, even if it was just to say, I'm super busy right now, but I will get back to you.
Yeah.
You answer every email. I mean, I've had such a difficult time getting young executives to adopt that practice. And we see it as producers all the time. People don't respond. They don't respond to emails. You have to send two or three emails. Sometimes, I mean, it's, to me, it's, I don't think they're mean or they're feeling, you know, like it's personal, but they just don't have this work ethic of, you know, everyone deserves a response. And you need to respect everybody in our business, because you're going to be in that position one day. It just, it's so simple, Michael, but, you know, you're a producer pitching. You know, I guess I'd say to everyone out there, don't be disheartened. Unfortunately, it's the way of our culture right now. And I hope it shifts back to people being more considerate and respectful, but it's not personal. So don't take it personally.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, the people, don't get me wrong, there are some people in the industry who do come back and are great at doing that, but it is not the norm. And when I do meet up with the people who it is not the norm for, they're no less nice. You know, it may often be a time management or management in general issue. And there are a lot of pitches, there's a lot of content being thrown around out there. But, you know, we would all like to have that response, wouldn't we?
I get back to people within a day, today, every day. When I was CEO, I don't care about how much time it takes. Within 24 hours, I answer everybody's email.
We need more Ricks.
Well, Fonda might disagree, but okay.
All right. So what happened after Mainframe?
Mainframe, again, we had a buyer, Rainmaker, which was then a visual effects company. The idea was to join visual effects and animation. Rainmaker came in and acquired Mainframe. Their management team came in. They made a deal with me to stick around for a year or two. I can't remember. And I stuck around and helped them in a transition. And then I founded my own games company, because I had a feeling that I could create a service company for game companies, where I had a distributive labor force. You know, I knew a lot of good modelers and asset builders and riggers and people who wanted to work out of their home, which is kind of interesting, because this was, you know, 2008,
yeah,
before, you know, pre-pandemic by, 12 years.
By a long shot, yeah.
You know, it worked. I had modelers, and we did work for like Nintendo DS stuff. We did little animations and assets, and we did some work on bigger games, just building, again, mainly assets, some animation for the DS games. And it was a nice little company. It was just the three of us. Three people I knew at Mainframe, and it was just something I kind of wanted to dabble in the games area. I liked it. We had done a little bit of cinematics at Mainframe, a little bit of motion capture at Mainframe. So I founded that company. I did that for a couple of years, and then Technicolor came calling. They needed someone to run their animation and interactive. It was, again, here we go, interactive and animation. So games and animation. I had done the Mainframe thing, and then I had this games experience. So now Technicolor finds me, and they needed somebody. They had been doing higher-end cinematics, like for God of War and Uncharted, bigger games. So they had a crew of about 60 people in Burbank, California, and then they had a few hundred people in India. Mm-hmm. And they had a joint venture with DreamWorks Animation in India, in the Indian studio. And they needed someone to manage all that. I didn't know anything about, well, I did know. Actually, I'd done work in India when I was at Mainframe. We had outsourced some work to India. So I knew a bit about Indian studios. So I was kind of a good candidate for this job. Technicolor is an interesting company because it's kind of old school. It's been around 100 years. They did all the film processing and color correction and post-production and services. But they also had this animation visual effects with MPC. They had bought MPC. My division was games and animation. MPC was a different division. We reported to the same guy. Again, another great experience. We grew that Indian studio from 200 to 600 people. We had done a lot of work for Nickelodeon, so I got to know the Nickelodeon people. You know, just a interesting international experience because I was going to India every quarter. And there were certain challenges culturally there. Technicolor had bought 65% of this company in India, so they didn't own it all. Mm. And the founder was, he liked to do things his way. He's a very bright guy. He's actually a cardiac surgeon. Gotten into animation. I don't know why, but yeah, we ended up parting ways with him amicably. You know, that company Technicolor India is doing quite well today. And the DreamWorks joint venture was interesting because it raised our bar quality wise at that studio. We were the only studio in India that was doing that kind of US feature quality work, which helped us attract other clients. And that DreamWorks joint venture was, you know, also quite a challenge to manage because the expectations of DreamWorks were not always in line with our expectations. So it was called on my management skills. But after Mainframe and going through what I had got through, really nothing could compare to those challenges. Yeah. You know, I was so seasoned by that point from Mainframe that I just took each day at a time. And you know, we managed with DreamWorks to launch that DreamWorks unit in India, and it was successful for a while. And DreamWorks decided to pull out of India at some point after I left. Anyway, I was at Technicolor in LA. I'd moved back to LA from Vancouver. I'd gotten my Canadian citizenship because I'd been in Canada long enough to get a passport. And then Sony came calling. I had lunch with Randy Lake and Bob Osher, the two executives at Sony. Bob was running this division that included ImageWorks, which was Sony's visual effects and animation studio. And they said, we want to get into Vancouver. And we hear you're the guy who knows Vancouver. They hired me away from Technicolor. I moved back to Vancouver and in 2010 started that studio. At that time, they put me in charge of the satellite studio. So Vancouver, Albuquerque, and India. We had a studio in India. Again, I had the Indian experience, so it worked. I had Vancouver and India. So my life has been a series of lucky opportunities that seem to fit my skill set. That Sony experience, I'm still associated with Sony.
Yeah.
After 12 years. I'm still working with them, producing a show. But my association with Sony has been the longest in my life, and great association, mainly because there's great people there. And even at Bardell, while I was CEO at Bardell, I managed to exclude a couple of projects that I had going with Sony. So I was able to keep the relationship going even through being CEO of Bardell. We went from 60 people to 700 people in 4 years at Sony ImageWorks. And that was quite a growth spurt and quite a challenge for me because imagine the logistics of having to grow a studio, just the logistics from a real estate and infrastructure perspective, let alone an HR perspective. It's quite challenging.
So much of the interesting, like really interesting development the last several years has come from Sony, you know, from Spider-Verse and then Mitchells. And then you see all of these other studios doing really interesting things and pushing the boundaries. And I just wonder if that would be possible if there wasn't a separate, you know, VFX animation unit like you had with ImageWorks at Sony, to be able to say, these are the crazy ideas that we've got. Can you help us just figure out how to make them?
Yeah, I don't think it would be possible. I think you're right on the money. The technical abilities of the people at ImageWorks from working on these high-end visual effects projects. You know, you're talking about, you know, the A-plus studio level features like Spider-Man, the live action movies, and, you know, I mean, Jumanji and but not just Sony movies. ImageWorks worked on a lot of other visual effects projects as well. That technical ability to create a certain look, I know, came to bear on something like Spider-Verse. And, you know, you have amazing talent at ImageWorks. You're exactly right. They go and they translate what's in the director's minds about how this movie should look. And they have that capability to do it. And it's unusual for a studio to be so successful in both visual effects and animation, but ImageWorks has really done it.
Yeah, I mean, and you're seeing now that model kind of being used with CineSite and DNEG with DNEG Animation. And I think part of that was born out of, you know, going back to one of your previous points where you said you had, you know, 300 people, but 100 of them weren't working on projects. And so you had to let them go. But, you know, that was something that didn't just happen at your company. It happened everywhere. And, you know, DreamWorks and Pixar, they all had people on long-term contracts and they would try and find shorts or different projects for them to do in between the features. And then, you know, from people I've spoken to over the years, that became less and less, you know, that your contract would not be renewed necessarily after a feature. And I know that, you know, some of the VFX companies had the same issue. Like, they had these big staff up, staff down peaks and troughs, and they started feature animation and animation units so that they could try and keep them, some of those people, you know, longer term. It's an interesting puzzle.
It is challenging. You want to keep that talent. So sometimes you do have to find those other businesses, and they're kind of happy accidents. You know, DNEG is interesting because I went to their presentation at Annecy, and they keep their animation unit separate from their visual effects unit, which I thought was interesting. At ImageWorks, people definitely get to work on both kinds of projects, which I think artists like. They like that variety, and but we're also mainly in one facility, you know, mainly it's all Vancouver now.
Yeah.
And some people in LA, but mainly Vancouver.
Yeah, whereas DNEG is spread all over the world.
That's right.
Which is more of a necessity in VFX for tax breaks.
That's right.
I know at Sony, you kind of spearheaded a lot of the series based on feature IP. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess what happens is after about 5 years, I seek a change from being an executive and want to go back to being kind of more entrepreneurial. You know, from Mainframe, I started that games company, three people. And after, I think, 5 years at Sony ImageWorks, I decided, I also wanted to come back to LA because of Fonda. And so I created this opportunity. I saw that Sony Pictures Animation, which was at that time run by Bob Osher, ran both Sony Pictures Animation and Sony Pictures ImageWorks. He was in charge of both.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to Bob and I said, look, Bob, I have an idea. Sony used to do this. They're not doing it now. Let's do it in a way where Sony doesn't have to take any financial risk. And, you know, as long as Sony's willing to give up some distribution rights, I think I can create some shows based on our Sony Pictures Animation movies like Hotel Transylvania and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. And so Bob gave me the opportunity. Of course, I went to Randy Lake, my boss at ImageWorks, and I said, I want to make this transition. How much time do you need? Let me help you find my successor. It's an interesting story. I moved back to LA. It all worked out. And I started, you know, marketing this intellectual property to companies like WildBrain and Chorus and other companies to see who wanted to produce these shows. They would have to take the financial risk. Sony would benefit from certain merchandising rights and fees. And when I got back after about a year, I guess my successor wasn't working out. So Randy Lake came to me and said, could you help me finish building the new studio? So I'm the only employee at Sony who ever worked for Sony Pictures Animation and Sony Pictures ImageWorks at the same time. I kept going on my producing stuff. Remember, we had the same boss, both. So he said, okay, so I would spend half my time in Vancouver working on building the new ImageWorks studio and half my time on these shows. We got the studio built, and then thankfully they found Michelle Grady, who's now running ImageWorks and is an amazing leader. And I came back and stuck with SPA, you know, Sony Pictures Animation, doing my thing. And I loved it. You know, I was creating these shows. I was a one-man band. It was just me. I was Sony's guy on these shows. So I was doing notes on scripts and animatics and design. And, you know, the other executives at SPA would chime in, and we would get these shows going. And yeah, it was real. It was a great experience for me. And then another executive job came calling. And this time I went to my Sony people and I said, look, I got this opportunity. I don't want to stop making your shows. Can I not take on new projects, but can I keep the slate we have and let me finish these projects for you? And they said, great, Rick, we trust you. We know you'll, if you say you'll do it, you'll do it. And I went to Bardell and I said, look, I can consider this job, but I need to finish my Sony stuff. And Bardell said, okay. And so I ended up going back to being a CEO. And Bardell had other challenges. They had quality challenges and some deliverability challenges that, you know, they had had some issues with clients, and they needed someone to come in and help them kind of repair a lot of those relationships and take the company up another level in terms of quality. And I think that's what I did in my 4 years there. I accomplished a lot of those goals and worked with our parent company in Italy to really create kind of a new Bardell, much more focused, bigger chunks of projects, less projects, but more on each project, more soup to nuts, pre-production to post-production if possible.
Yeah.
At a high level of quality. So that's what happened. I went to Bardell, I kept my Sony relationship. And I think, you know, that only happened because I try and be really transparent with people. You know, I spoke, I told them what I wanted to do. I told Sony, I told Bardell, and everybody was clear and kind of all worked out.
So interesting hearing about your career, because it's not like you've just shared your career. You have shared these nuggets of wisdom, you know, all throughout. And but more than nuggets of wisdom is just your kind of your outlook, like you say, your transparency, the talking about grabbing hold of opportunities. But a lot of that seems to come from, I'm guessing it came from your upbringing and how you were raised and the type of person you are. You know, we kind of started as you're in high school, but you obviously had some big influences when you were young.
Yeah, that's cool. You're right, Michael, very perceptive. My father was an entrepreneur, restaurateur. I watched how he treated people. Everyone who worked for him, from the busboys to the managers. And he was just a guy who really treated people with respect and kindness and humor. He was a real hero to me. When he was 50, he changed careers, which at that time was unheard of. He sold his restaurants and became a stockbroker.
Oh, wow.
And he worked as a stockbroker until he was 85, 35 years. And he had 200 people at his funeral. That tells you what kind of stockbroker he was. 200 people, yeah. You know. He just was a special guy. My mother, too, was an amazing person and you know, always giving and always really funny and kind. And, you know, just I had great influences from my parents, siblings. It shaped who I am.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like it. And your uncle also was a big comedy man. Is that right?
Yeah. My uncle just celebrated his 90th birthday. He was the founder of the Improvisation Comedy Club, which, you know, there are improvs all over the United States. And, you know, really was the first comedy club for stand-up comedians in New York. 1961, I believe, is when he started. Just celebrated his 90th birthday. At that birthday tribute were Jay Leno and David Spade and Kevin Nealon, and all these comics came to pay tribute to him. And he's quite an entrepreneur in his own right. Just a real interesting and admirable guy. He was my connection in the entertainment industry. He had moved out to L.A.
Yeah.
Kind of was why I wanted to go to California, because, you know, I would go and hang out at the Improv in L.A. and at his table, and, you know, all these comics would sit there, and it was pretty great. Kind of a different experience, but it certainly was more the glamour of the entertainment industry, you know. So it was great to have him as an influence. And still quite close to him.
That's great. That's great. And you've got, you still obviously split your time between Canada and LA. And I believe you've got a nice little vineyard up there.
Well, it's hard to call it a vineyard. It is a half an acre, but I call it a vineyard. So I'm going to go with it. It's a half an acre of Pinot Noir grapes that are being grown. And I'm in my 2.5 year point. So in another year, I'll have probably about 40% grapes ready to go. But it's been amazing watching these vines grow. It's in a beautiful part of British Columbia called the Okanagan. And it's a lake, a beautiful lake. Wine is quite good. And yeah, I've been lucky enough to, again, through a very close friend who first had Fonda and I out here for the weekend, to get to know this area and to have something here that, you know, is, you know, you can go out and walk the ground and know that you're actually making, you know, something in the ground. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, especially over the pandemic, doing some of the Zoom calls with Fonda, and she was showing me the view off the balcony there. It's quite nice.
There you go. Yeah. It's a great view. And it's an interesting story because, Fonda really liked this area, and she doesn't like a lot of places in terms of, you know, wanting to actually spend a lot of time in one place. She really took to this area. And I bought this house on FaceTime pre-pandemic, thankfully. I couldn't afford the house now, but pre-pandemic. And I bought it on FaceTime. I had the realtor show me. I saw that view. I said, man, this is it. And I didn't close the purchase until I had seen the house, but yeah. I did put the offer in and do it without ever having stepped foot in the house, which I would not recommend to anybody, but it worked out quite well.
That sounds great. Well, Rick, it has been absolutely amazing and a pleasure to chat with you today. I've really, really enjoyed it.
Me too.
Yeah. Wishing you all the best for your projects and your wine.
Thank you, Michael. All right. Well, you'll have to sip some with us, and, I'm sure you will, and I'll probably see you at MIPCOM next. I won't be at Kidscreen, but I will be at MIPCOM, and who knows what I'll be doing then. So we'll see. The new opportunity is always around the corner. Thank you, man. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for joining me. I hope you enjoyed that chat. If you'd like to get in touch or to shoot us any feedback, then please email podcast@thegreatersociety.org. You can find me on LinkedIn and other socials. As mentioned at the top, please subscribe, like, or share the podcast if you're enjoying it. Thanks to Rich Dickerson for the music, Mike Rocha for the mix, and our exec producer, Eric Miller. Thanks again. See you next time.